Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Tony Gilroy,
the writer of the new thriller starring John Hamm and Rosamund Pike, Beirut. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
First, I got to start off by saying it was thrilling. I love this genre, and I feel like we don't get. I mean, it comes every now and then, but there's so many superhero movies. That kind of thing is ruling the day, and we don't. I sort of miss this stuff. I mean, you wrote all the Bourne ones and Michael Clayton, and so I just want to say, keep going in this. What's the state of that genre? I mean, it'll be around forever, don't you think?
I don't know. It's. I mean, it's moving off the screen. It's going to your. It's going home. You know, there's a lot of great stuff. I mean, there's no shortage of thrillers on television. Getting one on the screen and getting people to leave their house to go see it is a trick, and it gets harder and harder to do that.
Yeah. Well, if they do get out and see it, I think they will enjoy it.
And they have to be done for a price. I mean, this is. We're talking to someone here today who had been to Park City and seen the movie in Sundance and thought, oh my God, this really isn't a Sundance movie. It's so expensive. And I said, I bet there were several movies at Sundance that cost way more than this did. I think people, I can't tell you what it cost, but you would be shocked how inexpensive this was made. So I think if people can, you know, pull off little miracles like this, they have a chance, but that's what it takes.
So you made it a little more economically than it seems. It seems like it's a big budget thriller.
I couldn't have directed this at this price. I couldn't have done it. I like to think that I'm really handy and frugal and efficient, but I never could have done what Brad Anderson did.
That's awesome. Let's go into your protagonist here. Right. I love that he's, you know, it's this, you know, this wounded hero. It's almost like, you know, Beirut's almost like his Chinatown, you know, like the place that he doesn't want to go back first, you know what I mean? Talk about how it was important to sort of set that up, and he's trying to, you know, he's obviously boozing, drinking out of the flask, and he's still a negotiator, but he's left his diplomatic negotiation, and now he's at this, there's that scene where he's at the a labor negotiation, and they're yelling at each other to strike. How important was it to sort of set that up?
Well, it really, you know, it's Paradise Lost for him, really. You know, you meet him in 72, and he's... you know, he's a mediator diplomat stationed in Beirut. He's married a Lebanese woman. He's sponsoring a 12-year-old Palestinian boy for an education in America. He speaks fluent Arabic. He's going to make his life here. He loves the Middle East. He loves his future. And in one night, everything is taken away from him. And as you said, you meet him 10 years later, and he's a low-rent retail labor negotiator in Boston. And I think I love that sequence. It does a bunch of things. It shows you that negotiation is negotiation and people not getting along. It doesn't matter if you're arguing over, you know, a 2,000-year-old disagreement or you're arguing over, you know, the insurance premiums on the union contract. People fight. And if people just shut up and listen and talk, there's a way out of it. But the movie is about, you know, and when he returns, I mean, it's the kind of thing that you dream of when you're trying to write. You know, the place he's returning to is as ruined as he is, you know, and he's coming back to a city that's ruined, and he's ruined, and everything is ashes, that makes for good storytelling, hopefully.
I love that line, the city is as ruined as he is. That's pretty genius, and it made me, and the perfect guy to cast in it, because he had the Mad Men line, we're flawed because we want so much more, we're ruined because we get these things and wish for what we have. When you said ruined, it made me click. Before we dive any more into the script, but John Hammond is like that perfect hollowed out individual, you know, he's like wounded, he's we've seen him do that in Mad Men before. Do you write with him in that in mind?
No, you know, I wrote this in 1991.
Wow.
And I wrote it in 91, and we couldn't get it. It was written as this big deal for me, like a big step up in class and my first real serious movie. And everybody's very excited about it, and we were going to go out. We went out to a lot of big people, and it was a really... You know, it was like a calling card for me, and it was it meant a lot to me. We could never get it made because in 1991, the politics of the film, because it's very accurate about what's happening in the winter of 1982 in Beirut, the politics were considered they were considered too inflammatory. A lot of people got afraid because nobody in the movie really looks good except for the hero. You have the PLO, which is corrupt. You have the Reagan White House, which is just a hornet's nest of bad ideas back and forth. And you have Israel, just horribly, aggressively on the border waiting to invade, looking for any excuse possible. And when the movie's over, they will find an excuse. And so everybody's behavior is poor. And everybody looks really bad except for John Hamm, who's come to save the day. That made for a perfect storm of people getting very close to making it and not making it. So 20 years went by, it disappeared. Yeah. I never thought about it.
Sure, sure.
And these guys, these producers, Mike Weber and Interscope, they pulled it out of a draw and they go like, we really like this. And it's actually sexier now that time has passed. 82 is really sexy and we'd like to go to John Hamm. And I was like, they're never going to get this made. Good luck to you. I've heard everybody drive off this cliff with this movie before. Right. Good luck to you.
They for like back, 20, they go, 5 years. Yeah.
No, good luck to you. Yeah. I didn't even think. We couldn't find my contracts. I couldn't. We never were able to find my original contracts. It was that far back. I said, good luck to you. And they call back. Well, John loves it. He wants to do it. We want to go to Brad Anderson, and we know you like Brad, and Brad wants to do it. I'm like, great. They're never going to get it. But we get a budget. They got a budget. I'm like, you can't make the movie for that, and you'll never get the money anyway. Oh my God, we have the money. We have a budget. Well, where? And then I had to rewrite the, then it was like serious. I was like, okay, I will rewrite the script. I'll tune it up a little bit. But I said, they're never going to get to the starting gate. And we went to Tangier, and they were like, day one. I went to the first day of shooting. I was like, I cannot believe this is actually happening. So, God, I don't know. John just perfect for it. I guess that's what the question began.
Yeah. And Rosamund, too. Speak about how she kind of brought it to life with that. Just even her readings on there and some of those scenes where she doesn't trust him. I thought she was perfect.
Man, you got to be. The women who were there, there were women there. You know, after this movie is over, the reality is when the movie is over, the movie probably is, say it's like February, March or something like that. In June, Israel will invade. 6 months later, the embassy will be blown up in one of the first suicide bombs ever. And of the 69, 70 people that are killed, there's a couple dozen women that are in that building that are killed. And there's a great book that came out in the interim. A bunch of books that have come out, but, you know, talking about some of the women that worked in the, I mean, you had to be a really, I mean, you can imagine how tough you had to be just to be anybody to be there, but to be a woman and to be there. And Rosamund has some steel. She really has steel. It's great to see, and it's really, I love what she does.
We saw in Hostels, too.
I know, I love what she
does. Of course, Andrew, but yeah.
Yeah.
No, she's great. Give me a little bit of a, we were sort of talking, let's go back to, you know, the protagonist. Give me a little bit of an anatomy, let's do like an anatomy of the scene when you're sort of sitting down writing. That scene when he finally goes back and sits down and they're trying to bring him on board to do the negotiation with the right. hostage situation. I love how he's, you know, almost flippantly saying, you know, oh, well, whatever, you guys do this, I half expected Cal to be here. And then they say, actually, he's the one that's been kidnapped.
Right.
Explain, I don't know if there's like an up-and-coming screenwriters listening to this, how important, how you actually go about getting to that point in the scene by sort of building up an expectation, then yanking the rug, and then you're watching it like the character saying, oh, wait
it's
a minute.
It's really interesting to say, because you have to be really careful. I'll say two things. These are sort of geeky screenwriter things.
I'm in, let's go.
Okay, so two geeky screenwriting things. One is that one of the things that I did do when I rewrote it 30 years later was I was very impressed with my, because you're collaborating with yourself over 30 years, I was very impressed with the young version of myself, how energetic and like my, how you know, my plotting. And yeah. I was like, wow, this guy's really good. I wonder if I could still do that.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of good energy. But the guy 30 years ago was very into like, he'd get a line and I would warp scenes around lines and moments. And I didn't let natural, everything wasn't natural. That scene is on the border for me of being unnatural. Good. It's such a great turn that you want the scene to do that you have to find a way to do it. So that's on the bubble for me.
For you, it's when you look back and you're like,
For me, that's on the bubble. It works because it's delivered well, and I was very, I really warned Brad about that and warned everybody. I said, please don't lean on this. See, a lot of times you say to an actor, particularly directing, like take the line out of this. Like, if I hear me when you say this, we're gonna change it. Like, make it so I can't hear me anymore.
Right.
The second thing is, and every screenwriter should know this, the best way to get plot out in a movie is people that do not. I don't know how you write a movie where people get along. I mean, the worse people don't get along, the more contentious they are, the more they disagree, the more different opinions there are, the more people dislike each other in the room, the easier it is to get plot out.
Well, it's all conflict, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Right, that's a good point, because if they all get along.
Nobody in that room is on the same page. You have five people in the room, nobody's on the same page. They all mistrust each other. And they're all looking at him, and he doesn't trust any of them. And it makes for good. They're not the hard scenes to write.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I just love it. In case there's writers or even moviegoers that like to sort of see the craft of it, you know,
right.
Kind of break it down. In terms of like planting either a clue or a red herring, the PLO thing, the pray love only. You know that you have to deliver that aha moment when he realizes
right.
that. But then how do you? I guess you know that first, and then you go back and plant the other way. Or does
well,
it
you're talking about
out?
A scene where a guy's talking in code.
Yeah,
I mean, for the people who haven't seen, there's a scene where they have to talk in code, and they have very limited time. And I'll be again to geek out screen wise. That scene. Really, really comes close to the edge of not working on the page.
Yeah.
And I was, again, that's another scene that I really went over with Brad and said, man, look, this has, I would have, if I was directing the scene, I would be really nervous on that day because it could really be, you have to get the pressure on, but they have to get the information over, but it can't be cheesy and it can't be too much. That scene works so much better live than it does on the page. It happens every now and then, and it's to Brad's credit, and Mark Pellegrino, who plays the part, is great, and John is there, and Kareem. That scene, when I saw it, there's a couple scenes that don't come up to my expectations. I won't tell you what they are.
But that one,
and it's such a crucial scene, and it's so far exceeded what I ever thought. I was like, wow, that's. So they crushed that. I wasn't there when they did it. But man, I was so happy to see that work.
Like, oh, thank God.
No, I know, right? Because if it doesn't, it's like, yeah. Oh, God, what a letdown.
No. Well, it's such a pivotal part, yeah. All right, well, I know we got to wrap up. So I guess in closing, I want to talk about growing up, Brothers Gilroy. I know your dad was a Pulitzer Prize winner, yeah. And saying, you know, need to say more. I had a fraternal twin, and we made movies as a kid. And I know, I guess, Dan and John are fraternal twins.
They're fraternal twins.
They're fraternal twins as well.
My
are you?
Brothers, yeah.
You're the older
I'm
one.
I'm the oldest. Yeah.
Okay. And just for our listeners, you know, we're talking to Michael Clayton right here, but Dan made Nightcrawler, which was badass,
yeah.
Right? And then John was the editor of a lot of the Bourne stuff.
Yeah, everything. Yeah, John's credits are.
Yeah. Anything you can
John
imagine.
John worked on many more films than either one of us because editors work. John's one of the best editors on the planet.
Yeah, but I just want some sort of tidbit of what it was like growing up. Were you guys always into movies? Did Dad give you pointers or no? You just found your own way individually? Or?
What's the shortest version? I mean, great father. My father was a great father, and he was an only child. And he was really extremely into fraternity and the fact that we get along. So he baked into us getting along. We grew up in we grew up in upstate New York in a place, and went to public high school in a very unusual place that Michael Clayton grew up. Our school was a real mess, not a great education, and a really rough and tumble place that we grew up. And we sort of had this sort of secret big life in the middle of a really rough and tumble community. And the only way to fit in and the only way to get over was to be part of that, you know, rowdy community. And our childhood was pretty like, you know.
So it wasn't like a creativity childhood.
No. No one knew it from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until dinner or whatever. No one ever knew what we did. We lived in the woods in bikes with guns and mini bikes and drugs and just it was mad and very rugged, and I think in the end it looked really terrible for a while for us. I think
helped that you in the long run.
But in the long run, like we always worked, we always had blue collar jobs and all this stuff. There was a toughness about it, and yet at the same time we all knew we had this really weird secret that we had this other life. And the summer we would go to Europe and we would go to Broadway and we would we had this intellectual life, and we had to defend it on the school bus all the time. So you had to be really tough and you had to be rowdy and you had to stick up for yourself. And some of that grit really came in handy as we all became journalists and bartenders and musicians and figured out our way through this. And it helps out along the way to be a little. Everybody works hard. We're hard workers, I guess. Yeah,
I think you nailed it. I mean, I think it may give you a well-roundedness and a lived-in sort of grit experience that maybe if you had just taken that normal route,
nobody
you know,
paid attention to us when we were growing up. And now, I've raised my own kids. You just watch them all the time, and you just can't help but messing them up. But people need to be Kids need to be free range.
We need to get back. We need to bring kick the can back, man.
Yeah, exactly. The kick the rusty can back.
Kick the rusty can. All right. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure.